You're listening to the LifeScan Learning Lab edition of the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie and my co-host, Todd LeDuc, episode 71.
Welcome to the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
Hey, folks, this is Dr. Donnie, and I am telling you I'm excited that the Get Balanced podcast has an official sponsor, and I want to tell you a little bit about them. And it is FirstNet, built with the AT&T. And what I want to tell you about them is probably part of it is that many of you already know this, but for first responders and frontline workers, communication, as we know, is not a luxury, but it's a lifesaver. And that's why FirstNet, built with AT&T, was created. Now, the FirstNet mission is to make communication faster, safer, and more collaborative for first responders and other public safety personnel. FirstNet helps first responders and frontline workers connect when they are on and off duty. They get access to priority and preemption capabilities. This means they connect to the network first. In emergency situations, first responders move to the front of the line to access critical bandwidth they need to send and receive, whether it's voice, data, video, images, and text. Now, during an emergency, FirstNet is a critical connection between first responders to technology and also to each other, giving them access to information quickly and when every second counts. With FirstNet, first responders and frontline workers get a highly secure, reliable network with 24/7, 365 customer care and monitoring. Now, to get more information about FirstNet, go visit your local AT&T store or visit firstnet.com. Now, let me go in and introduce our guest for this week. Hey, folks, you're listening to the LifeScan Learning Lab edition of the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie and my co-host, Chief Todd LeDuc, also known as the Chief Strategy Officer for LifeScan Wellness Centers. And Todd, thanks again. It's always a pleasure to do a show with you, and I'll kick it over to you to announce our special guest this morning.
Absolutely. Donnie, the pleasure is mutual as we continue. I've lost track how many episodes. I think we've taped somewhere, I don't know, 15 or 16, and they're rolling out every Thursday. And we've just had some phenomenal friends and guests, and we've covered so many different topics in the service. And today is no different. And it's one a topic that's near to my heart, having spent 30 some odd years in public safety. And I'm thrilled that we've got Captain Dina Ali with us from Raleigh, North Carolina Fire Department is her home base, but she's done a tremendous amount of work and continues to do so. I was just with her, seems like forever, but a couple months ago at the Texas Fire Chiefs, first time traveling back on the road from the pandemic, and she does a lot of work on behavioral health, and I want to dive into that a little bit today. But Dina, welcome. And before we get started in conversation, maybe if you can, Donnie tells me we've got an audience from all over the globe. So for folks out there that are listening that may not know you, maybe if you can talk a little bit about your background, how you got into the service. I know I'm intrigued that you've had kind of a journey of crossing public safety careers. So maybe if you could touch on that a little bit too, and just get our audience familiar with your journey.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. I'm excited to do this show today and see where it goes. But I was just that tomboy growing up, and sirens always caught my interest. I loved being outside. I played sports. I rode my bike. I still ride my bike. I never outgrew that. And what I've learned about myself is I never outgrew all of my childhood passions. So for me, growing up in the 90s, Cops was on. And every Saturday night at 8 o'clock, Cops was on. And no matter what, I was watching Cops. I wanted to be a police officer. I thought that was the coolest job. And then that show Third Watch came on, and that really solidified my desire. So I always wanted to be a police officer. I made friends with our school resource officer in high school. he was just one of the nicest people in the world. We developed a really good relationship and friendship. I went off to college. And while I was in college, there was a scholarship that I found. It was called the Police Corps Scholarship. So you applied for the scholarship, and if you got it, it paid off the rest of your college. And in return, you owed 4 years of service. But, and this is where maybe I should have done more research. I was born and raised in Raleigh, which is the capital of North Carolina. It's a pretty progressive city, but not all of North Carolina is like that. Well, with that scholarship, you had to agree to work for a smaller agency. And now looking back and now being a little mature, I understand what they were doing. They were trying to get college educated, people with diverse backgrounds into these smaller communities to kind of create change and to add diversity to these communities. But for me, it was 2002. I was super stoked. I went to Smithfield Police Department. Smithfield is only 30 miles away from Raleigh. It's not far at all. But in terms of progressiveness and whatnot, Smithfield is very far away from Raleigh. Going to college is unheard of for a lot of people. The community was still very segregated. I mean, we legitimately had a northeast, south, and west side. And, you know, the south side was Hispanic. The north side, you know, was high income, predominantly white. The west side was older, a little more mixed. And the east side was very low income and a lot more Black. And so for me, it was just really weird because the way I was raised in Raleigh, Raleigh is just so diverse. People come together. I went to NC State. You know, I thought that the old days were behind us. And then I started my law enforcement career and realized that the old days weren't really that far behind us. And I was different. So I quickly transitioned from Smithfield to Garner Police. Garner was also a part of the scholarship. And Garner is in Wake County, right outside of Raleigh. So that was a really good move for me. I felt like I fit in a little better in that community. But two things happened in that time. The television show Rescue Me came on TV. And the Garner Fire Department is a really awesome fire department. And I was kind of getting to my 5-year point in law enforcement. And now I've learned that that's when a lot of officers face burnout. And a lot of officers leave at that 5-year point. And I was really getting to that burnout. I was getting frustrated with the court system. You could do a really good job, have a really good case, and go to court, and a little technicality would get somebody off. And something that I saw was a person's income dictated if they got off or not. And, you know, for me, what really frustrated me was I might have a decent human being who made a mistake, but they didn't have the financial resources in court, so they got screwed. And then you have a person who was drinking, who was arrogant, who was rude, who was belligerent, who took no responsibility. And because of the amount of money they had, they got off. And it just, I took a lot of stuff home. I remember, you know, the hardest part being a police officer is when you get called to something, you're always called after the fact. So you don't see what happened and you have to hear two sides of the story. And I just struggled to know who was telling the truth. And I would try to make the best decision that I could. But there were plenty of nights, and I still remember that I'd go home and it would just eat me up wondering, you know, did I get fooled? Did I, you know, arrest the wrong person? Did I not help the right person? And then, of course, every call you go on as a police officer, maybe I would say 95% is truly after. I'll never forget at the end of my career, I went to a call where a mother called me and she believe that her babysitter had sexually molested her child. And she described what she found and what she noticed. And that just, I hated it. I felt like there was, you know, not much that I could do. I couldn't protect that child ahead of time. So law enforcement just started to wear on me. And then of course, a big thing that I noticed with it was everybody lies. The victims who call you, they exaggerate their story. Suspects lie. I mean, witnesses lie, everybody lies. And I got very, very tired of the law enforcement side. So I want to say I have the utmost respect for anybody who is a law enforcement officer who's able to stick with it. Because I remember when I got to the point of transitioning, it was, I can stay in law enforcement, but I can't care as much as I do, because that's the only way I'll survive. Or if I keep caring as much as I do, I just can't stay in it. So that's what made me transition. Like I said, the television show Rescue Me was on season 2. They had a female firefighter. And that was the first time I thought, like, I had seen a female. And I was like, what? That's something I can do? And so the Garner Fire Department, all, you know, there'd be scenes where it was like awesome wreck and they got on scene and they cut the car open, they got the person out, man, they're doing all this amazing work. And then they leave. And I got to sit there for like 3 hours and I didn't do anything. So it was little things like that. And I go by the firehouse, hang out with them. They're always cooking amazing food, watching TV, laughing. That was the big thing that I remember with the fire side compared to the law enforcement side is they always seem to be laughing. So that's what made me transition. And I've never really looked back.
Well, that's a fantastic, unique and fantastic journey. And I have to say, you went through a list of TV journey that took you along with them. But Cops was, we have that in common. I actually grew up watching Cops. It was filmed many times with Sheriff Nick Navarro in Broward County, Florida. In Broward EMS at the time would always be shown treating with their paramedics. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up in Broward County was the TV show Cops. So, and for my generation, Emergency 51, you know, spawned Squad 51 and Engine 51, a whole generation of first responders. So it's the power of media in shaping influences. But I want to, before we delve into some of the work that you've been doing, I want to echo what you said. And I know Donnie feels the same way because he works with a lot of law enforcement members and law enforcement officers and agencies. And I've only done one ride along in my career on the law enforcement side. It was a felony traffic stop. And I joke, I was the only guy that came to the party without a gun, which was very, very uncomfortable. But I can't, you know, in LifeScan, we see 50,000 first responders a year across the nation. Many of them, we started with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. So for our audience that may be listening, I mean, I just want to echo, Dino lived it, obviously, but the tremendous amount of respect that I know I and Donnie have for our law enforcement community. It's a job I don't think I could do, but I'm glad we have folks out there that are on the front lines, tip of the spear, protecting our community and our children. And so thank you for what you do and your service, Dina, even though you got hijacked by Rescue Me. And we're thrilled to have you on the fireside now. But I want to touch on a little bit about, you know, where you've focused your efforts and your passion. So if I'm not mistaken, I believe you've done some work and some research on the issue of suicide in the fire service. And you know, and for those that are listening in the audience, we know there's a whole constellation of behavioral health challenges that first responders are confronted with. And at that far end of the spectrum, tragically, can be first responder suicide. But if you would, you know, why don't you talk a little bit about the work that you've done, how you became engaged on the issue of behavioral health and some of the work that you've done in creating networks. I know in North Carolina, you've got a very active peer support network across the state that others emulate. Maybe we can just talk a little bit about that again, for whether you're on the law enforcement side or whether you're on the fire side, or whether, you know, Donnie's former military and his family is, you know, very strong military family of service. You know, that toll that serving takes on our responders.
Yeah, so 2015, I had my first promotion. I made driver and I was so excited, you know, ready to like pump some fires, get to act a little bit, you know, everybody's so thrilled about their first promotion. But with that promotion came a transfer and I ended up at a really slow firehouse and that sucked. But one of my friends who also got promoted with me and somebody that we've come through most of our career together, he started graduate school. And it's funny when you, that with that first promotion came the first time where you're writing reports and I'd been
I'm still trying to figure out how the junior driver ends up at the slowest house.
Yeah. So for the driver, when the captain's off, you end up in the captain's seat. So that's the first time writing reports. And it had been a while since I had actually written things that people read. So I realized that my writing had gotten lazy. And so when he decided to go back to graduate school, I was like, hey, you know, I can give it a shot, see if I can pull it off and it will help me with my writing. So I started graduate school, and the fall semester, of course, like right when I get involved in school, they do a realignment of companies. I was on our special operations team, and they were like, hey, that shouldn't be all the way here at this slow station. We need to come closer to the city. So I got moved in to a busier firehouse, which was awesome. But one of the personalities there from day one, he just had nothing for me and wouldn't speak to me. And very quickly, it kind of, the way he treated me, I guess, became contagious to the other people in the firehouse. And all of a sudden they started like keeping a distance, and it started to bring me down. But also I was still in school and I had an assignment that semester. It was action research. So basically, and I was getting a master's in public administration. So with that, I was allowed to focus a lot of my research on public safety, because they really wanted us to improve like municipalities and cities. So within the fire service, I was allowed to look into things that were affecting us. So that assignment was find an area where current practices are not best practices, research, help develop better practices. Our safety officer at the time was a really good friend of mine. So I just sent him an email and I was like, hey, this is my assignment. What's something that I could research that could benefit the fire service and benefit our fire department? And I was thinking it'd be something to do with RIT, you know, maybe more aggressive fire attack. I wasn't thinking at all behavioral health. That had never crossed my mind, never been talked about in the Raleigh Fire Department. But he came back and he said, hey, can you do some research on firefighter suicide? And I was like, holy shit, man, what does he know? Because at that time, you know, a few months had gone by to where I felt extremely isolated in that firehouse. I remember one day that person was really disrespectful to me, and I had put my foot down. I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I put my foot down, and it ended up with like a little shouting match. So the captain finally did his job, and he pulled us inside, set us down, and was like, all right, hey, what's going on? And that person, I mean, flat out, he was like, man, I just don't like her. I have no use for her. And the captain looked at me and was like, hey, so do you know what's going on? I'm like, well, I think he just said it. And so I don't even remember that conversation being resolved, but I remember afterwards, the captain pulled me inside and was like, hey, you know, I see what Tim's doing. I see you don't deserve it, but there's nothing I can do. So if you just keep doing what you're doing, you know, it'll be all good. And for me, I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, I don't want to create any problems in the firehouse. I want us to, you know, be mellow, cool. I'll keep doing what I'm doing. Thanks for noticing. But the message he sent me, underlying message, was I wasn't worth it, that I was below, you know, the status of a human being that was worth somebody standing up for them. And I also felt that with, it was a two company firehouse, the ladder company there, they were all decent guys. And it was funny how when this person, Tim, was off, we got along and talked and things were great. When Tim was there, nobody would talk to me. And it made me feel really shitty. And so it was crazy how I just got in my head and allowed myself to get like overcome by negative thoughts. And, you know, over the years of my research, I have a better understanding of why that happened. But at the time, of course, I had no idea. I remember my family, they were proud. They were like, man, she's been promoted. She's doing good. But I was so humiliated by what I was experiencing at work that I couldn't face my family. I couldn't face my friends. And I really isolated myself outside of work as well. So, you know, I'd get to work every day and today would be the day that we were going to come together. I was like, man, I hope we have a big fire. I hope I do good things. And, you know, we all become a family and hug each other and we're all friends. So every day I came in with a positive attitude. It was like this big mask I wore. By the end of the day, there was no progress made. I felt even worse. I remember I'd get in the car, drive home, and I would just cry some days. As soon as I get home, even if we were up all night, I'd get in bed and just, you know, go to sleep. I had no energy. I had nothing. I didn't want to be around anybody. I picked fights with people I love because I just, you know, I don't know. I was acting out. I went and saw my primary care physician. And the first time I went and saw her, I was like, hey, I think my thyroid's messed up because I have no energy. I'm gaining weight. Can you check my thyroid? And she was like, no, your thyroid's great. So I went back and I was like, I think maybe I'm depressed. Can I have some pills to make me feel better? So she was like, cool. Yeah, here. She gave me some pills. I took them for a couple of weeks. The side effects sucked. So I went back a third time. was like, hey, I'm still depressed. These pills didn't work, and I have different pills. She gave me more pills. She never referred me to a therapist or a clinician. So that third time she gave me pills, I didn't like the side effects on those. So I just quit taking them. And that's when things started to get really bad for me. You know, I went from thinking about suicide fleetingly, maybe once a week, to once a day, to multiple times a day, the thought of suicide came. And the more the thought of suicide came, the worse I felt, the more ashamed I felt, the more embarrassed I felt, and the more I knew I couldn't let anybody into what was going on with me. It really just started to overwhelm me. And I remember at night, like at midnight, you know, the thoughts would get really intense. And I would think about calling Suicide Prevention Lifeline. I wanted to reach out so bad. Like I wanted to understand what was going on. I wanted to talk to somebody, but I was so afraid of, you know, what would happen if I admitted that I was having these thoughts. And I remember like, I really had this, like very rational conversation with myself in the mirror one day when I was trying to decide what to do. And it was like, Dina, you have two options. You're thinking about this a lot. So it seems like a really good outcome. You're miserable in life right now. Things aren't getting better. They just keep getting worse. They're not going to get better. So suicide is a really good option. If you want to do this, you can't let anybody know, but you are also thinking about talking to somebody. So you have to make a decision. Do you keep it to yourself and die by suicide? Or do you talk to somebody and ruin your chance of dying by suicide? So that was like the fight that I was having with myself. But fortunately, at the exact same time is when she pops and said, hey, can you research firefighter suicide? So I was like, holy shit, what does he know? Like, oh my God. So I went, pulled up a couple of articles, and I remember then it's so funny the difference, I mean, that 6 years makes. When I had those articles at the firehouse, if anybody walked by, I'd turn them over. Like if I was working on the computer, I'd click out of the screen because I did not want anybody to know what I was doing because we weren't talking about this. I was so scared that somebody would see what I was doing. But fortunately for me, as I got into the research, a lot of things resonated with me. And one of the first things I found was a dissertation written by Dr. Janet Sabia. She is a psychologist. She's actually in North Carolina, but she's one of the premier people who got to work on firefighter suicide. Her dissertation, which she wrote in 2007, and if you get a chance to print it and read it, all the recommendations, everything she wrote in there still holds true today. We have been just really slow to get to where she was in 2007. But so she was the clinician who, she went and got every death certificate of every firefighter in North Carolina. And she compared the numbers that died by suicide to the numbers who died in line of duty. And she's the one who found that 3-to-1 number. But what was alarming about her research was she said there were a lot of sealed envelopes that were confidential. And we can only imagine because the data she looked at was from 1984 to 1999 when suicide was even more stigmatized. So we can only imagine that there were a lot that were suicides and they were confidential. But also a lot of the research that we found has also said that law enforcement and firefighters, when they died by suicide, they were more likely to be listed as accidental or, you know, unknown to protect that officer or protect that firefighter and their family. So all that's to say, we don't know exactly what the real numbers are. But beyond that, because what I've learned is focusing on numbers and comparing line of duty death to suicides is a big waste of our time. And I'll explain that later if you want to get into it. But she discovered that for first responders, the big thing is that mask that we wear that says that we have to be protectors. That mask is what prevents us from acknowledging our own problems in our lives, whether, you know, they're relationship issues, something very minor. And she found, and especially she was one of the first people, and I was surprised in 2007, she found that rates of suicide for women and minorities was much higher because of their inability to quite fit in. And she pointed to that and she explained a lot of data on that. But the big thing, and she included Dr. Joyner's research on suicide, where the two big pieces that he found were that thwarted belongingness and that perceived burdensomeness. So basically he says, and this has been echoed by all the research after, is that there's a final pathway that most people travel before they reach the decision to die by suicide. And it doesn't matter what any of the other reasons or feelings are, but everybody ends up in this final common pathway. It kind of funnels into two big interpersonal feelings. One is thwarted belongingness. So it's not just you don't belong, it's that you're pushed out of belongingness. And then the other one is perceived burdensomeness. So the feeling, and it's perceived because it's a misperception. So the person feels like their existence is hurting other people, that their existence is, you know, making other people worse and they're not contributing. So she echoed that, he echoed that. And, you know, for me, just reading that, and especially one thing that she said in there was, and this is what really resonated with me, is she said that especially when people feel that what brought them to this depression is so minor compared to the big issues of the world. So I remember me at that time, I was depressed because I had a guy in the firehouse that wouldn't talk to me and treated me bad. So here I am, like a 30-year-old adult professional that is upset because somebody's being mean to me. So that made me feel even worse. I felt like my problem was so insignificant compared to people who've lost children, who've witnessed trauma, you know, have had so much more significant events in their lives. So that's what really made me feel even more ashamed and unable to open up. And that was something that she explained in her research was overwhelmingly the people dying by suicide were also feeling that same way, that what they were experiencing was insignificant compared to the big problems of the world. And to this day, I see it where we still struggle to admit what our true, you know, causes of pain are. We feel like we have to blame our job. We have to blame trauma. We have to blame the calls we see because it's too hard to say, this is what I'm experiencing. This is how I feel. Went really all over the place, I hope. Did I lose y'all?
No. First, let me say thanks for sharing your personal story. You know, it takes courage to be able to do that. And I think it's important also to know, you know, there's probably a lot of deaners out there in the service today that are struggling with very similar circumstances, whether environmental or, you know, I want to, you shared the very unfortunate, sounds toxic environment that you were part of. You know, in my service with the IFC, we started an anti-bullying campaign called Respect Your House. In fact, we'll be doing a workshop at FRI in 2 weeks. But it's important because, you know, when we live under the same roof, if we're not treating each other the way we would expect to be treated, it has oftentimes devastating consequences. So thank you for sharing again. I want to ask, you know, when I hear the challenges from a behavioral health front, what are, in your mind, what are the go-to resources? I mean, I know we see at LifeScan, we're one of the, I think it's only 10% of annual exams that do any type of behavioral wellness screening. So, you know, we try to catch behavioral health issues at the early stage, just like a physical disease process. So, but you touched on the importance of, you know, clinicians understanding and then being able to align and connect the dots in terms of treatment and intervention. But for departments and individuals that are listening to this, what are some of the resources that you believe are essential to making sure we have in place for our members?
Yeah, no, and I'm glad because this is an easy transition to get to where we need to be. So every bit of the research I did, whether it's Dr. Sabia's work, Dr. Joyner's work, the work from the military, all pointed back to the same thing. And remember, one of those variables in the final common pathway was thwarted belongingness. Well, to offset that is social support, belongingness. So every bit of research, no matter what it was, it pointed to the need for strong feelings of connection and strong social ties. So the first step to getting where we need is first being able to say, this is what I'm experiencing, and not feel judged, to be able to share your experience, because what was really harmful for me was feeling so ashamed by my experience that I didn't share it. And especially the fear that if I went to a clinician, that I would be put in a like suicide hold, you know? So that really silenced me. So everything I found pointed to peer support. And we try to overcomplicate peer support, but peer support should be extremely simple. It should simply be people who've had different experiences, who have had some training on active listening that can help somebody open up and share their struggles. And then from there, the peer's job is to be a bridge to resources. Because what we've learned is, yes, you can get through it on your own. And I took 3 years to get to a clinician. If my primary care physician would have gotten me to a clinician, it would have taken me maybe 6 months to feel better instead of 3 years. And in fact, I do want to point this out. They found that in the year before somebody dies by suicide, almost 80% go to their primary care physician, because what we know is mental pain and physical pain strike the same receptors. In fact, they're prescribing Tylenol to help with physical or mental pain because it's the exact same receptors. So people who are thinking about suicide are enduring significant emotional mental pain, and that leads them to a primary care physician. But less than 20% of people who died by suicide went to a mental health clinician in the year before their death. So one thing that I see, and this is not something the fire service can solve, this is something nationally, our primary care physicians, the physical side, they need to be attuned to what people are coming in for. The fact that I went in three times with depressive symptoms and it was unrelenting, she should have referred me to a mental health clinician, but that's a whole nother way. I won't get too far into that. But so the peer's job is to listen to somebody without judgment. A very difficult piece of the peer's work, and a lot the piece that takes a long time for people to understand, is you can't give advice. Your job's not to give advice. And the reason for that, there's three main reasons. And Brené Brown did an awesome podcast with the author of The Advice Trap. There's actually a book called The Advice Trap. And the three reasons why giving advice is so harmful is, number one, you're probably not solving the right problem. Because like I mentioned earlier, people struggling in the fire service with interpersonal issues, issues from their early life, issues with relationships, oftentimes they're still going to point to the job. They're going to point to, you know, what the symptoms are, but not what the underlying issue is. So the first reason is you're probably going to solve the wrong problem because somebody's going to come to you and they're not going to give you their underlying issue. Number two, your advice is biased. All of us have biased advice based on from our life experiences. I've been researching mental health for 6 years, mental health with the fire service. I still have biased advice. So it's not good for me to give somebody advice because my advice is going to come from my experience. But the third most important reason why we shouldn't give advice is, as long as you're giving somebody advice, you're above them. They're below you. As long as you're giving them advice, you're disempowering them. You've got to support them without judgment and empower them to make those decisions. So what the peer does is say, hey, do you mind if I share some resources? Do you mind if I share my experience? And this is what helped me. And all of this is just to lead people down the trail to make their own decision. Ultimately, somebody has to make a decision to see a clinician on their own. You can't say you need to see a clinician because you're disempowering them. They have to say, man, wow, that worked for you, or wow, you speak really highly of this. Can you help me get in contact with a clinician? So the peer's job is to help somebody see a clinician. One thing that I did learn from my experience, I think is really helpful. I remember the day that I finally decided to go to a clinician. While driving, my hands were sweaty. My pulse was like 180. I was scared. I did not want to go. All I wanted to do was turn around and go home. And the only reason why I didn't is because of my role with peer support, my role doing this, I had to practice what I preach. And I've talked to a lot of people about this, and everybody kind of said the same thing, is it's really scary to go the first time. So something that we do is just offer, like, hey, do you want me to give you a ride there? Do you want me to meet you there? Because that holds that person accountable. So that way they don't turn around. And then also it lets them have support. But I'll never forget, as soon as I walked into her office, immediately all that fear went away. I just felt really good. And after that first visit, it was a huge amount of weight off my shoulders. It was incredible. So peer support, the best way to work is to first of all, make sure you have people with those diverse experiences, have people trained, make sure that they're not trying to solve the person's problem, be their savior, but actually connect them to resources. And then the hard work on it is having the good resources, making sure our clinicians know who we are, what we face, what struggles we have. You know, I know we don't have enough time to dive into sleep, but we're learning how sleep is really and truly one of the most significant moderators to all of our behavioral, physical health. And it's not always the calls we see. Sometimes it is our lives that are impacting us. So the clinician has to be open to understanding us based on, you know, what we experience. So getting those culturally competent clinicians who understand the sleep, who understand the relationship issues when, you know, three Saturdays in a row, the first responder's at work and is missing family events, all those things. So those culturally competent clinicians are just so incredible. But something, Todd, that I wanted to hit on, and I'll surprise you with this because I don't even think you know we're going to go in this direction. But you before we started, you talked about how do we get ahead of this? You know, right now, peer support, it's still reactive. Having clinicians, they're still reactive. Now, I will say this, but we're all so busy, it's hard. Seeing a clinician like twice a year, man, is the best thing any of us can do, even if you're in a good space. It really gets ahead of things because we have blind spots. We all do. Our minds protect us from bad. And as long as they're protecting us, they're creating bad. So we should all see a clinician just as a routine checkup. It doesn't hurt. It's very helpful. And that's why agencies who invite clinicians into their houses to get to know people and have those clinicians available are one step ahead. But beyond all of that, we have to teach our people resiliency very early in their career. And so the military instituted mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's an 8-week course on mindfulness. And they instituted it in basic training. And the findings are amazing. They compare the soldiers who had the mindfulness training to the soldiers who did not have the mindfulness training. And those soldiers with mindfulness training had significantly lower rates of PTSD, anxiety, depression, suicide. So mindfulness works. It's amazing. And forever, we just didn't have an avenue to achieve that in the fire service. But we do now. So Jay Betancourt out of Asheville Fire Department, he's working with a guy named Scott McGregor, who has been doing mindfulness for years. Scott is a clinician, PhD, super smart dude. And they've created a mindfulness-based stress reduction course for the fire service. They've done this in Asheville for the last several years, and they've done the research on it. They have such positive results. They've done it in Charlotte, and they've actually compared recruit classes, the recruit class, because Charlotte sometimes runs two at a time. They've compared the recruit class who's had it to the recruit class who hasn't. And not only are they seeing improvements with mental health, but they're seeing improvements with behavior, with reactivity. So a quick story about myself. Tim impacted me with the way he treated me in a way that maybe he wouldn't have impacted a lot of people because I had my own vulnerabilities. My vulnerabilities came from early life. My parents are immigrants. My parents were really demanding. We're a Muslim family, and Muslim girls are not tomboys, but I was a tomboy. So all that's to say is growing up, I got in a lot of trouble. Growing up, I was an embarrassment. I was constantly being like having negative reinforcement on who I was. And that got into my head that I was a bad person, that I was wrong. There's something wrong with me. So that's why when Tim treated me the way he did, I reverted right back to the depression I had as a child or the feelings I had growing up. So what therapy does is it helps people understand how their thoughts and emotions impact their feelings and behaviors. And it really helps you when you have a thought that starts to go to a feeling, how you can actually adjust that feeling and recognize, hey, this thought doesn't have to make me feel this bad. So therapy helps people do that. But mindfulness teaches that before the person has to. So mindfulness is such a simple practice. It teaches the person that there's a space between stimulus and response, and that space is yours to own. So you can have a stimulus. You know, Tim can mock me. Tim can make a comment after I say something, and I can immediately react by getting upset. Or when you're in a firehouse with people, you learn not to get upset. You learn to bottle your feelings. So my reaction was immediately depression. I hate myself. I'm wrong. There's something wrong with me. That was my immediate reaction. Whereas mindfulness teaches you Tim's behavior has nothing to do with me, you know? So it teaches you to pause and adjust your reaction. So getting mindfulness training in our academies is going to make such a huge difference. And it's an 8-week course, but it's not an all intensive 8-week course. It's literally 8 hours total. So it's sprinkled throughout the academy to teach people that skill. So basically, they've learned that it takes 8 weeks for something to become a habit. So that's why it's an 8-week course. And it's really getting them to practice mindfulness just, you know, 5 minutes at a time. And it's really cool to hear how Asheville's instituted it. Like during RIT training, after a drill, they'll pull the recruits out and just have them stand in their boots and go through a 3-minute mindfulness where they learn that their breath is their anchor. And every time the mind wanders, you use an intervention to come right back to your breath. So I'm so excited about that. They're going to start their first train the trainer in December. I met with our administration at the Raleigh Fire Department. We're going to send 5 people. So our next academy will be able to institute this mindfulness training to it.
Hey, I love your personal story, Dina, and all that you're talking about. And with the mindfulness and when you're talking about the stimulus response, the thoughts, feelings, you know, the think, feel, act, right, cycle, of which is a part of cognitive behavioral therapy, which I think, you know, if anyone looks up think, feel, act, you can get some great information on it. And it's very, very helpful. I wanted to, as I was sitting here listening, if I could take you back to when you got pulled into who pulled you into the office to have the conversation with Tim? Not name, but which position?
Our captain at the time.
The captain. I want to get your guys' thoughts on this when you look back at this, because when you a lot of this focus has been on Tim and the way he behaved. But if we really get to a root of the problem, and Todd, I think you mentioned this, is that what you're doing with the fire chiefs, you know, the anti-bullying, it's really about what leadership, what behaviors are does leadership allow to happen? You know, whatever those worst behaviors are, that's the culture of your organization. I don't care if you're a fire department, law enforcement department, or running a McDonald's, it doesn't matter. Leadership's leadership when it comes down to it. And I want to get your thoughts on that, because that in and of itself, look at the different path that it could have happened if that would have been taken care of, that type of behavior is not acceptable, period. What are your thoughts on that? I'm interested in both of your thoughts on that, on leadership.
Well, that was the reason I took the captain's test, is I said, you know what? I'm not going to be in a situation where somebody can control the way other people treat me and not stand up for me. So that's what gave me the courage to say, you know what, I'll do it myself. And, you know, in my research, and as I've learned to lead, inclusivity is so important. Having a family is so important, and sacrificing yourself to take care of your people. So at the time, it was uncomfortable for my captain to be a captain. He just wanted to come in, have a good time, have friends. He didn't want to do his job. And unbeknownst to him, by not doing his job, he really hurt me. And I didn't know it at the time, how bad, you know, his decision to not do his job impacted me. So today, and, you know, I remember, like, a lot of the research said, you know, the role of the company officer is to ensure that nobody is being harassed, taunted, ostracized, to make sure that everybody feels welcome, and to really know your people and see how they are, and be able to tell when they're starting to isolate, or be able to tell when their behavior changes. And when you see that, to do something to help them, to make them come back together. I'm glad y'all hit on that. And as I was telling the story, I looked at both of y'all's heads and I saw, like, immediately, like, that, you know, it frustrated you. And I was happy to see that, because for me, when I was experiencing it, I had no idea that he wasn't doing his job. Todd, I'll let you take over, because I think you have a lot more knowledge and experience on it.
Yeah, there's been a lot said on this topic, right? Whether it's, you know, God rest his soul, Bruno, the late Alan Brunicini, you know, core value of you know, be nice. One of my mentors, Joe Lello, chief at Broward, you know, so these are principles people should learn in pre-kindergarten, but not everyone does. But Donnie and Dean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, one of the most important decisions we make is when we select a member into the service is making sure, like any other organization, we get the right person. And that speaks for leaders too. I mean, when we promote people up, whether it's, you know, Dina, your first promotion to driver where you're acting up as an officer, it's important to have those candid sit downs and what the expectations are. And it's not to be everyone's friend. It's to lead and have the courage to lead. You know, the challenge is, I'm sure both heard me say it, Dina lives it. There's no secrets in the fire service. There's no secrets in the firehouse. Everyone knows what's going on. So by not addressing these issues, it really, in many ways, becomes a cancer that spreads past Dina and past that one individual that may be impacted. The rest of the house then sees that's permissible. That message spreads through the culture of the department. So the next house now thinks that's permissible. So, you know, I think as particularly, and it's challenging, I get it. I mean, I came from a Metro 900 person department. It's challenging to sit and have this conversation with every company officer, particularly as you promote. But really, we need to make sure as leaders, we're giving them the tools to lead, right? Because oftentimes we promote people, we give them a badge and we don't give them, you know, the necessary leadership training. But we also have to have these, you know, candid cultural discussions that these are core values and these are red lines in the sand, you know, and ultimately if you don't address them as the officer, you now you own them. And that's, you know, unfortunately I've been in a situation where I've had to demote officers, terminate officers, for failing to lead in these type of situations. And, well, it's not fun to have to do, and it's, certainly not something you relish doing, it sets the precedence that the organization is not going to tolerate failures in leadership. Particularly, you know, Dina's case is a prime example. When you look at the impact it has, you know, and she's focused just on her impact, but I'm sure it impacted many other people in the organization knowing what she went through, whether they knew it as it was happening or later found out about it. That takes a huge organizational toll that is difficult to recover from. So again, I thank Dina for sharing the story, because I know there's lots of other Dinas out there. She pointed out, particularly in male-dominated hierarchical paramilitary culture, if you're a minority, you know, the research tells us you're at higher risk. So I know we're pressed for time. There's a ton of, obviously we're going to have Dina back on. Hopefully, as when Donnie releases this, we can include, how to get a hold of Dina and her contact. I know at LifeScan, on our website, which is, lifescanwellness.com, there's a toolbox resources tab that is dedicated exclusively to behavioral health. So all the stuff that the National Volunteer Fire Councils put out, the IFF, the peer support programs. But definitely if your organization is does not have some resources in place, and Dina just touched on evolving resources that, you know, are great to start looking at the successes that other departments are having, whether it's mindfulness or any other resource that we can put in place to protect our folks. We need to be doing that. So
yeah, I would like to ask you, Dina, is if there's someone listening that they themselves are feeling isolated, they're starting to notice some of those symptoms that you discussed, or if they are seeing one of their brothers or sisters in the firehouse or in the department, what can they do? What, especially the people that, you know, you're noticing someone that, wow, this person seems to be isolating themselves. What do you recommend the track that they take?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. I think that's so important. And it's such an important thing to talk about. So first of all, if somebody is struggling, like I was struggling, I don't know if you remember what I said. I was thinking about suicide and I wanted it so bad, but also I wanted to talk to somebody. And the research has found that people who die by suicide up until the moment of their death are deeply ambivalent. The will to live, the survival instinct is so strong that you can never fully erode it. So even in that person's death, there was a piece of them that wanted to live. And they learned this from the Golden Gate Bridge jump survivors. So of the people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and die, less than 3% survived that jump. Of all the people who survived that jump, every single one of them said, and it's a 4-second drop, by second three, they wanted nothing more than to live. Every single one of them wanted nothing more than to live. So that speaks to that ambivalence and that people want the pain to stop, but they don't want to die. So with that being said, the most amount of research is concentrated on the suicide prevention lifeline. Their job isn't to find where you are and send somebody to lock you up. Their job recognizes that people who are suicidal are deeply ambivalent. And their job is kind of like to take somebody that's on that teeter-totter thinking about suicide and give them hope and push them to life. Because what we found is when people die by suicide, they're overwhelmed with hopelessness and they need to replace that hopelessness with hope. And hope is actually so much more simple than we try to imagine it to be. It's just about finding small attainable goals and setting a path for reaching those goals. So the call takers with the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, they're trained to understand this and they're trained to help that person tap into hope and just push them to make it through. So the first thing I would make sure that everybody has the number for the Suicide Prevention Lifeline in their phone, 1-800-273-TALK. Even if you think you'll never need it, you having it and sharing it will put it in somebody's phone and maybe they'll call it when they need it. Also, if you are helping somebody and they're in a really, really dark place, there's nothing wrong with calling the Suicide Prevention Lifeline and putting it on speakerphone and getting a little help. So first and foremost, for anybody who's struggling in that dark place, don't be afraid to reach out. Don't be afraid to make that phone call. Peer support is absolutely amazing. The guys at Next Rung, they've done a great job creating a national peer support network. So they've got a number. You can look up Next Rung and get that number. I don't have it off the top of my head. But don't suffer in silence because you're not alone. Todd mentioned, you know, there's a lot of other Dinas out there. And honestly, when I first started lecturing and talking about this, I never shared my story because I'm still humiliated by it. I came at it from a researcher perspective. But every one of my classes, somebody came up to me and told me their story, which was like my story. So I was like, man, okay, I've got to start telling my story. So now that I do share my story in each of my classes, at the end of class, so many people come up to me. You're not alone. There are other people in your agency struggling. So don't be afraid to reach out. Know that you're not alone. If you are noticing somebody who is isolating, you're noticing somebody's changing, their behavior has been changing. The best thing that you can do is be a decent human being. It's so simple. We overcomplicate this. People are afraid to help others because they think they're not trained. The best thing you do is just walk up to somebody and say, hey, I've noticed this and I care about you. What can I do? You have to tell them what you've noticed because what we've learned is people who wear that mask, the minute they find their mask isn't working and people are seeing within them, they drop it. They're like, oh, it's heavy. Thank you. So tell them what you've noticed. But a big piece of it is to say, I care about you. I want to be here for you. But you can't be an asshole who gossips all the time and talks about people and is hateful and then think that you can go up to somebody and tell them you care about them and they'll open up to you. So you've got to be a decent human being every day so that when you do come to that person, they know, man, I never hear, you know, Todd talking crap about people. So I know I can trust them. And Todd truly does care because day to day he cares. So I think to, you know, take this fire service, take law enforcement, take public safety one step forward, we have to be cognizant. Like if we really care about PTSD, suicide, we've got to be decent human beings day in and day out. Stop gossiping. Show people you care. When you see somebody struggling, let them know, I see you struggling. This is what I've noticed. Do you want to talk? And then if you are worried that they're thinking about suicide, if they've made comments, if they talk about being a burden, if you get that gut instinct, and I've talked to a lot of really smart people on this. Brandon Dryman's one of the smartest ones, I would say. And we all agree that there's no formula. There's no algorithm to tell you when to ask. You get that gut instinct. So if you are truly worried, you need to ask somebody, are you thinking about suicide? The research has found that by asking that question, you take that person who's struggling and you allow them to open up and share their struggles. And by doing that, if they're thinking about suicide and that's the only option they're thinking about, when you let them open up, it will help them find other options. So if you're truly worried, ask the question. Don't be afraid to ask. Try to know some resources ahead of time. Agencies that don't have peer support, it's okay. It's not that hard to get it going. Invite clinicians into your firehouses. One of the things that I think works really well, you'll find probably 20% of your members already have a clinician. Put out a SurveyMonkey, anonymous, send it to the whole department. Hey, do any of you guys know a clinician that you think would work well with other people in public safety? Do you mind sharing? And people will share. And then you reach out to those clinicians, invite them in. And that's how you can start, you know, just having those resources available.
That's awesome. And I appreciate the help on that. And you said 800-273-TALK,
I believe. Yeah, and it's going to become a 3-digit number in the next year. That's just been approved. So that's going to be awesome.
That'd be great. And I'll put that in the show notes as well. So back to you, Todd. Let's close it out.
I want to thank you. We talked about a ton of useful information that I know is going to make a difference in the fire service and in individuals in both law enforcement and fire service. And I thank you for having the courage to not only share your story, but to commit your efforts to help change the service, make it a better place for those that are in it and coming up behind us. So I know we'll be looking to have you back on because there really is so much more. We just scratched the surface of it today. There's so much more that we need to continue this dialogue, and I'm just happy we're having the conversation. So thank you for taking time out of your day and sharing your insights. And Donnie, we'll certainly include a lot of the references we discuss. So we hope that for those that are listening, those will prove to be a roadmap for you, your department, and ultimately a healthier and safer fire service and law enforcement service. So thank you.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, guys. Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balanced program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.